The opinions expressed on The Gay Life are those of the host and his guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Metromedia Incorporated.
And now, from the gay capital of the Western Hemisphere, KSAN San Francisco presents The Gay Life. Good morning. I'm Randy Alfred, and this morning we have an absolutely fascinating, revealing interview with Camille O'Grady, who was an ear witness to the death of her close friend and manager, Robert Opel, on July 8th. There are a number of unexplored aspects of that murder and the events subsequent to it, which Camille and I will discuss very candidly later in the show. We'll also talk to Jim Rivaldo and Dick Pabich of Rivaldo Pabich and Friends, a Castro Street campaign consulting firm. But first, some news of the continuing efforts of gay rights advocates to loosen up the strictures imposed by the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service on the entry of homosexuals into the United States.
I think they're crazy. I think that the Immigration Service is displaying its usual intelligence in wasting the taxpayers' money in these kinds of foolish endeavors.
That was the voice of Don Knutson, Executive Director of Gay Rights Advocates in San Francisco. Knutson was referring to the detention of Mexican nationals Javier Cruz and Eduardo Roman by the San Francisco Airport Bureau of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Cruz and Roman were detained only hours after Judge Stanley Weigel had dismissed the Immigration and Naturalization Service's case against British photographer Carl Hill. That occurred on the day after Surgeon General of the United States Julius Richmond announced that the Public Health Service would no longer certify homosexuality as a disease, and that the Immigration and Naturalization Service would not be able to rely on certification of homosexuals in order to exclude them. On the day before the August 4th conference, gay rights advocates had announced their victory in the Carl Hill case.
On behalf of Bill Dillingham and Don Knutson, and of course Carl Hill, I'm very pleased to announce that we have won this case. The Public Health Service, the Surgeon General, has issued a memorandum to all offices that they will no longer certify homosexuals as excludable aliens. And the District Director of the Immigration Service in San Francisco has withdrawn his order to have Carl Hill appear for an examination. That is everything that we had hoped for at this time, and we're just very, very pleased at the results.
Jeff, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What are your plans for the future? Are you going to go after the law itself?
If the appropriate case arises, it is my feeling that this action by the Surgeon General makes that particular section of the Immigration Act a dead letter, unenforceable in effect.
That was the voice of Jeffrey Katzoff, a law clerk at Gay Rights Advocates. And he was perhaps being prophetic when he said, if the appropriate case arises, because when he spoke those words, the detention of Cruz and Roman at San Francisco Airport was already underway. When he referred to Bill Dillingham, he was referring to a lawyer from Pillsbury, Madison & Sutro, one of San Francisco's most prestigious firms, who joined Gay Rights Advocates as co-counsel in both the Carl Hill case and in the new case involving the Mexican nationals. The next day, another press conference was held at Gay Rights Advocates to discuss the new case.
All right. Yesterday afternoon, approximately 1 o'clock, Judge Weigel signed the order of dismissal in the Carl Hill case. I think you're all familiar with that. Roughly the same time, Javier and Eduardo arrived on a flight from Veracruz to San Francisco. Pardon me. Eduardo was stopped by an immigration officer and questioned about his sexual orientation. He was then asked about the sexual orientation of his companion, Javier. They were arrested, detained for 12 hours at the San Francisco airport in the custody of immigration officers and Brinks Burns guards. A friend of Eduardo, who was at the airport to meet them, called us here about 5 o'clock to indicate that they wanted to have legal representation. They wanted to know what their rights were, to decide whether or not they were to go back to Mexico, the immigration officer gave them one of two choices. He said, you may get back on a plane at 1:30 this morning back to Veracruz, and everything will be okay. You'll be able to return to the country at any time. Or, he said, you will have to be detained, locked up with a guard until Monday morning. When you go before a judge, it will do you no good. The judge will simply order you deported, and then you will never be permitted to return to the country again. The same story with respect to Carl Hill. They did withdraw their applications for admission at that point and had decided to go back to Mexico. But after Eduardo, on pretext of calling his family in Mexico, was able to call his friend here in San Francisco, and who told him that they did have some rights, that then they decided to change their minds. Immigration would not permit us to talk to them. We had to get Judge Ingram to issue a writ of habeas corpus, which he did about 10 o'clock last night. At 1:15 a.m. this morning, they were released in our custody. We have a hearing before Judge Ingram at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. Monday morning.
Does this mean that at this point immigration has not at all changed their policy, or do you think that this case is going to underline what we learned in the Hill case, and perhaps we're going to see some altering of policy out at the airport so that this doesn't happen again?
Well, clearly we're going to see. We will now be able to litigate an issue that we were unable to do so in the Hill case. You see, the Hill case determined only that the Public Health Service had no authority to conduct psychiatric examinations of arriving aliens to determine their sexual orientation for the purpose of exclusion. The Immigration Service, obviously as a result of their action yesterday afternoon in arresting these people, has taken the position that Public Health Service be damned, they're going to go ahead and try to exclude homosexual aliens on their own initiative. We believe that there is no authority for them to do that. The law simply says that people afflicted with psychopathic personality or people who are sexual deviants are excludable from the country through the certification process. The Public Health Service has indicated, and that's what the Carl Hill case settled, was that homosexuality is not a mental disorder. It is not either psychopathic personality, nor is it sexual deviance. I don't know what immigration is going to do, but it's clear that they believe that they have the authority to exclude without certification.
Is the law going to have to be changed?
The law need not be changed at all. The law is clear. The law is clear that there is no authority for exclusion of homosexuals solely based on their sexual orientation.
If that's the law, what do you have to do?
What do we have to do? Well, we have got to go to a hearing. We've got to have a judge determine the congressional intent, decide whether or not that is the law, and issue an injunction against the Immigration Service from continuing this outrageous policy.
Do you view this then as being a landmark case?
Oh, of course it is. It is one of the most important gay rights cases to date, in my judgment. We will finally establish once and for all that the government cannot discriminate against gay people by using psychiatrists and medical terms, the sickness theory.
Are you sure that the only reason that these people were held, are you absolutely positive that the only reason that they were held was that
Indeed. The order from the Immigration Service, from the immigration officer, was that they were suspected of being excludable under the psychopathic personality portion of the statute, the number of which I do not know.
Were these the same immigration officers that stepped up?
They were not, no. And you need to know as well that the district director of immigration here in San Francisco, Mr. Ilkert, was informed of the arrest and approved of it.
How was Eduardo chosen for questioning? What caused them to single him out?
We don't know. All that I know is that he was wearing a small gold earring in his left ear.
That was Don Knutson speaking at Gay Rights Advocates on August 4th. The Monday hearing he was referring to occurred on August 6th when Judge Ingram continued his order preventing the Immigration and Naturalization Service from deporting the two Mexicans. An exclusion hearing will be held this Tuesday, August 14th at 1 p.m. at the Immigration and Naturalization Service offices at 630 Sansom Street. At 2 p.m., on the same day, the Committee for Immigration Justice is sponsoring a picket line outside the hearing at 630 Sansom Street, Tuesday, August 14th. For more information on the Committee for Immigration Justice, call 441-4188. Once again, that's the Committee for Immigration Justice, 441-4188. Last week, we spoke to David Ilkert, the district head of Immigration and Naturalization Service in San Francisco, and asked him about these cases. Why is the Immigration and Naturalization Service continuing to detain homosexuals at the airport?
Well, the Public Health Service, the memorandum I assume you're referring to by the Surgeon General, says henceforth and directed public health officers that they were no longer to certify homosexuals as mental defects based on the latest medical opinions of the National Psychiatric Association.
Okay.
So they were directing, the Surgeon General was directing his remarks or his instructions toward that part of an exclusion ground that referred to mental defects. But the entire ground of exclusion reads, a person is excludable from the United States who is a psychopathic personality or a sexual deviant or a mental defect. And in the past, the Surgeon General has certified homosexuals and found that they're excludable from the United States because they come within the terms sexual deviant or psychopathic personality. So what he is at the present time, he is keyed in on the phrase mental defect, and he said a homosexual is not a mental defect.
We asked Mr. Ilkert several more questions, but they produced no further information. We did, however, have the honor of interviewing British photographer Carl Hill at our KSAN studios shortly before he left for his triumphant return to England. Carl, with your visit now drawing to an end, it seems as if you're much heralded immigration case when you entered the United States shortly before Gay Freedom Day has become just the start of a veritable cascade of new law on gays and immigration.
Yes, it has. And it's good, isn't it, really? I didn't realize at the beginning that it would get to the sort of disproportion, but it's just this, it seems to me the stupidity of the immigration that's carrying this on. I mean, it should have really stopped with my case.
Right. The Immigration and Naturalization Service, however, seems to not want to move into the 70s and 80s along with the Public Health Service.
Right.
It was the Public Health Service which issued a directive that they would no longer cooperate with the Immigration and Naturalization Service in doing so-called psychiatric examinations of people to determine whether or not their homosexuality constituted a psychopathic behavior as defined by Congress, which briefly summarizes what the entire case was about. Now, when you came to the United States early in June, you weren't planning to spend this long here.
No. My lover and I decided we'd come here for a quiet holiday. We'd shuffle around for a couple of days reporting the gay parade, and then, you know, we'd just be sort of very private people and just go and do ordinary sort of touristy-type things. But we found ourselves right in the middle of it and leading the parade, which was amazing, actually, amazing.
At the center of an international cause celeb.
Yes, quite.
Well, you're a press photographer for Gay News of London, which is one of the world's outstanding gay newspapers. How did it feel to be on the other side of the camera lens and at the other side of the newsmaking activity?
It felt very awkward to begin with. And I wasn't quite sure how to handle it. And I did get a little scared at times. But I had a little coaching from my lover, who's far more used to doing that sort of thing than I am. And after about 3 or 4 days, I began to settle into it. I mean, I had to, otherwise I think I could have gone crazy.
Did you ever have any kind of near despair of wishing that it hadn't happened or that you'd gone back and
constantly
had a quiet constantly?
Yes. Constantly in the first 2 weeks while my lover was here, because we would suddenly stand on a street corner and couldn't make up our minds which way to go. And we'd have an argument, and then we'd have to stop, look at one another and say, look, this is silly, you know. And the pressure of getting away from the press all the time. And we were sort of held up in the hotel room for about 3 days, not being able to sort of get out. And that sort of caused an awful lot of conflict between the pair of us. But, I mean, we're level-headed enough, and we've been together for 8 years to be able to sort of cope with it. But it was good having, the pair of us together so we could bounce things off of one another.
Now, his case wasn't as crucial and wasn't being contested, so he was able to leave earlier without biasing your case?
Well, no. You see, what happened? I mean, he got through immigration without any trouble at all. And once he had got through, and then all this happened to me, he turned around to immigration and said, well, what about me? I'm gay. And they said, well, no, sorry, we don't want to bother about your papers because we've already processed them. So they didn't want to go through any more bureaucracy, you see.
Typical bureaucratic mentality.
Yes, yeah.
Well, there's a mistake, but it's already done. So. So what have you been doing? You've suddenly found yourself in San Francisco without the resources. You weren't planning to spend this much time. It costs money to live in the city. And here you are being our test case.
Yes. I'm lucky enough. I've got the GRA, Gay Rights Advocates, have taken the case on. They've won the case, my case. And I've been asked to go around and speak to people and help raise money for GRA, which is helping me to stay here as well.
Both in terms of meeting their legal expenses and your day-to-day living expenses of having essentially being captive to a lawsuit in San Francisco.
Yes.
Well, I can think of worse places to have to be a captive to a lawsuit.
Oh, absolutely.
And it did, in fact, create new law. Do you think there's anything in the karma of Gay News of London to be involved in major lawsuits? First, there was the Mary Whitehead...
White House, right.
Issue over the printing of the erotic poem about Jesus.
No,
Gay News was actually convicted of blasphemy under a 300-year-old statute.
Yes, that's right.
And then one of their star photographers gets caught up in an international immigration dispute in San Francisco.
It does sound suspicious, but I mean, the staff of Gay News do try and report news, not try and make news. I mean, there's enough news to report anyway, besides making it. It's just that it's a gay paper, and all sorts of oppressions come down on a gay paper, and the blasphemy thing was an ideal opportunity for Mary Whitehouse, and she's taken it all away.
How has Gay News been treating this incident with your arrival in San Francisco and immigration?
I've been on the front page of Gay News, which I mean, it's something to say in England, that you've been on the front page. In fact, I've been on the front page for 3 issues now, and it's a story of incredible interest to people in England and in Europe, because not many people, very few people indeed, know that this law existed. And perhaps they would just come to San Francisco or America, New York, and be asked the questions I was asked, and then end up getting on the next plane back, and not realizing that you can go ahead and contest this. Admittedly, some people don't feel like doing it, and it does take an awful lot of courage.
I would certainly think so. I've crossed many borders in my life, and I never liked the whole attitude and demeanor of most customs and immigration officials. And I haven't actually done any international travel since coming out of the closet. And I wonder now, whether or not I should start thinking about all kinds of gay discrimination and so forth since then.
Yeah, I've traveled most countries in Europe, and there's never, ever been any problem at all. And I didn't even think of being a problem after I got off the plane here. I knew there was a problem before I left London, and I'd hoped that my lover and I had settled all that by talking to people and at the embassy in London. But obviously they weren't in touch with people here in San Francisco.
What about the mainstream media in Britain? Has there been much in press and television?
There has been some, not as wide as obviously as it is here. There was one point where a leading newspaper in London ran a banner headline saying, gay Britisher stopped immigration for being a psychopathic personality. Well, this was libelous, and I had a telephone call from my lover saying, do you want to sue, do you want to sue? So I said, well, I don't think so, but we'll ask for a public apology, which I got almost immediately.
From which newspaper?
This is The Guardian. I like The Guardian anyway. I really didn't want to sue them. I mean, I knew they would give me a public apology anyway. And it's taken all sorts of... my lover went back and had to do a television program on our own gay parade and spent several minutes talking about what had happened to him in San Francisco myself.
Your visit to San Francisco, as it turns out, with the parade and being at the center of the writing of new law on gay rights, although no further than the Immigration Service wants the precedent to go no further than it possibly can, and is now contesting it with the case of the two Mexican visitors. Have you had a chance to meet them? There's an overlap of your visits.
No, I haven't. I'm hoping to meet them perhaps later today. And I think we could start a new club.
The kept out at the San Francisco airport.
Yes.
I was turned back. And apparently their friend who called Gay Rights Advocate probably wouldn't have even known of that possibility had it not been for all the publicity attendant upon your case.
Quite. I mean, you know, as much as all this has been quite horrendous, the publicity has been good. And we're actually getting to people and letting them know exactly what sort of oppressions there are left. Because, you know, a lot of people here in San Francisco don't realize there are still oppressions, because this is a sort of mecca for gay people. And once you're inside the sort of ghetto, you forget that oppression does still exist on the outside. And we've got through, I think.
That sounds like what you think the message of all this is for San Franciscans to remember. What are you taking back out of this in terms of what you think you should teach your other gay people in Britain and throughout Europe?
One thing this has taught me is that gay people in Britain should be far more organized, because here, as soon as it was realized what was happening to me, lawyers and press people were mobilized immediately. I mean, GRA, it's only been going for two years, and they are very, very quick off the mark, and they're doing an incredible job. And this is the sort of thing I'd like to see happen in London. We take our time in doing things. We get them done, but we're not as efficient as we could be. We have one saving grace, and that's Tom Robinson. I mean, he's the best thing that's happened to English gay liberation for years. And back in London, he got up at the gay parade and said to people, petition the American Embassy, petition the Home Office for the Carl Hill case. This is wonderful. I know Tom, and he really meant this from the bottom of his heart, and this is really nice.
Okay. Thank you very much for being here with us this morning, Carl Hill, on The Gay Life on KSAN.
Thank you.
Thank you. The 6 p.m. curfew is to remain strictly enforced for the time being.
Today, institutions fundamental to the British system of government are under attack. The public schools, the House of Lords, the Church of England, the holy institution of marriage, even our magnificent police force are no longer safe from those who would undermine our society. And it's about time we said enough is enough and saw a return to the traditional British values of discipline, obedience, morality and freedom. Freedom from the reds and the blacks and the criminals, prostitutes, pansies and punks, football hooligans, juvenile delinquents, lesbians and left-wing scum. Freedom from the niggers and the packies and the unions. Freedom from the gypsies and the Jews. Freedom from the long-haired layabouts and students. Freedom from the likes of you!
That was the Tom Robinson Band, and Tom Robinson and Carl Hill, we have learned, will be leading a demonstration in London this Tuesday in support of the rights of gays to visit the United States without being hindered by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. That will be a support demonstration for the one occurring in San Francisco at 2 o'clock on Tuesday, August 14th at 630 Sansom Street. That's 2 o'clock, Tuesday, August 14th, 630 Sansom Street. This is The Gay Life on KSAN. And later in the show, as we said before, we'll be speaking to Camille O'Grady about the death of Robert Opel and about some very unusual, unexplained circumstances that followed after that. Some of these things have not ever been discussed or printed in public. It'll be a very interesting interview. But first, we talk to Jim Rivaldo and Dick Pabich, Castro Street's hottest campaign consultants. Good morning to both of you.
Hello.
Hi, Randy.
How did you both come to San Francisco and find each other as political campaign partners?
Well, I came to San Francisco a lot before I found Dick as a campaign partner. I just, living in the East, I really wanted to come to California and ended up here. We got together first during Harvey Milk's campaign for the State Assembly in 1976. Worked on that campaign and found ourselves working on his campaign for supervisor, and one thing led to another, and here we are.
What part of the East are you from, Jim?
I'm from Rochester, New York.
And Dick, where are you from?
I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I came out here like most gay people, sort of wandering out to San Francisco, and wasn't really involved in politics for quite a while until I read of Harvey's name in the paper when he was tackling the establishment. And I thought he sounded good, and so I came to walk down to the store and met him and Jim and got working.
So you're brought together essentially under the aegis of Harvey Milk.
True.
That's right.
And how long have you been working together now?
Well, 3 years, I guess. Yeah. After Harvey's campaign, I went off to law school, and Dick went off to start an advertising company with a couple of partners also that he met through Harvey's campaign. And then the following year, when Harvey ran for supervisor, I live in District 4, and I helped in Ella Hutch's campaign and Carol Silver's campaign, and the two of us found ourselves working on more and more campaigns, and I gradually faded from law school, and Dick pulled out from his advertising agency, and then after Harvey was elected, Dick went to work for Harvey in City Hall, and So we have, on and off, just this past spring, we finally got our own office and stopped working out of each other's apartments and basements and things.
Who are the friends in Rivaldo, Pavlich, and
you.
Friends?
You have lots of friends. And
you
we
and
call
all
on,
the listeners out there.
We call on all of our friends to help us out of troubles and tight situations and all that. So we thought they should get some recognition.
As opposed to the usual and associates, mm-hmm. which
well, no one would associate with us, so we had to take
them. So you had to call them friends. And so your new firm is located on Castro Street.
Right. In the heart of things.
Yeah. In the heart of things. And whose campaigns are you doing this year?
Well, we get involved in lots of different things on different levels. At the moment, we're doing a lot of the work in the Harry Britt campaign, Carol Silver's campaign for district attorney, Supervisor Lau's campaign for re-election.
Doris Ward running in District 7 against Bob Gonzalez.
And we're working on a campaign for next year's congressional elections in the North Coast counties. Peter Windrum, a Democratic candidate who wants to unseat a long-term Republican. Yeah.
We also have been doing things in conjunction with the Campaign for Economic Democracy, rent control type things. We did the stuff for the Hayward rent control campaign that lost very narrowly a couple of weeks ago. And we work on, we've done some things for the rent control campaign here in the city. And different, well, we did some stuff for a man who won an election to the Bakersfield City Council last spring.
We've done things for Hayward. Very high places.
Yeah. And what is it exactly that you do for a candidate? What do campaign consultants do?
Well, some campaign consultants do a lot of things like polling services and mailing services and all that kind of thing. We concentrate on the political propaganda and the graphics and that sort of thing, and general political advice. And the friends that we have we'll call in to do, you know, whatever other services. We're not big time highly paid consultants that sit around in smoke-filled rooms and that kind of thing. We're more interested in just in a portion of it.
We each candidates come to us with different needs. Some candidates really have no idea what's going on, and we have to start from scratch. And often, you know, we don't know either, but we learn fast, I guess. And sometimes candidates have a pretty clear idea of what they want to say and how we say it, how to say it, and then we get a lot of direction from them. But we in most cases, actually start from scratch researching issues, writing it all up, and then designing it into, we hope, interesting and useful pieces of literature. We also do the silly stuff like balloons and posters and buttons and all the other very important aspects of the democratic process.
Bill Barnes in The Examiner did a series on campaign consultants a couple of weeks ago, and seemed to indicate
didn't mention our name, I remember.
Well, you've gotten publicity also. Marshall Kilduff did a piece in the Chronicle.
Sure. Yes, and actually Bill Barnes announced to the world that we were working in Dianne Feinstein's campaign, much to ours and her surprise.
And you are not?
No.
No.
Although something had been under consideration and
well, in the beginning, I mean, we mutually, and they were interested in us and we were interested in them and all that, but $1 million couldn't get me to work for Dianne Feinstein at this point. Anyway, you were saying.
Well, you seem to indicate that it's not all as, that political consultants, campaign consultants, aren't all as powerful in being kingmakers and queenmakers as Barnes talked about.
Well, the people in that article were the real high-priced, not terribly committed to a political ideology. They're interested, and they're mainly, you know, interested in the campaigns that can produce a great deal of money, and they're mainly interested in issue campaigns rather than candidate campaigns, I think.
Well, there's one fundamental theme that runs through everything we try to work for, which is how do these candidates and how do these issues relate to the gay community? And especially last year, it was pretty overt, the No on Six campaign and all that. And you know, frankly, we demanded a price of the people we worked for, and we really got no resistance. And it was not that, you know, we had to force anybody to do anything they wouldn't do otherwise. But the literature we produced, people running for assessor, people running for BART board, We managed to squeeze in a little statement about how outrageous Proposition 6 was, and these people, whether they were a Latino or black or Chinese or whatever, in their literature to their communities and to their constituencies said that they were opposed to Prop 6. And I think that, you know, little things like that added up to where, in general, the whole atmosphere of the election last year was made it completely unacceptable that anyone could possibly in a million years think of voting yes on 6.
Didn't you also do the literature for San Franciscans against Prop 6, the orange brochures
that floated around? Yeah,
yeah, that was that's actually one of the things we felt most pleased about, was that opportunity. One nice thing about the No on 6 campaign was that it gave us a good excuse, the gay community as a whole, a good excuse to really talk about gay issues to everybody in the whole city. I mean, everybody in the city received one of those rather densely packed No on 6 pieces of literature, either in their mailbox or at their doorstep. And it was really fun to have that excuse to do that. And it was really a big responsibility, and it was fun.
We're talking to campaign consultants Jim Rivaldo and Dick Pavich here on The Gay Life this morning. Jim and Dick, what kind of division of labor do you have between you in terms of who does what?
Well, I do all the good stuff and he does all the bad stuff. No, yeah. Actually, we both do everything.
Yeah.
We both come from sort of different experiences. I worked in City Hall for Harvey Milk for a long time and learned a lot of things about how the system operates. Jim came from a background of neighborhood stuff and a legal background, and so we take that and our talents as graphic designers and general political whizzes and end up doing everything, you know, pasting up brochures with type and running around handing them out to and writing them and all of that.
We both of us, we both design things, we both write them, we both choose the photographs, and there's really a very fuzzy distinction between us. Some of us, sometimes I do things that Dick never sees until they come back from the printer and Dick the same way.
You've used the term design around three or four times, Jim. Now is that essentially what you do as campaign consultants, is design a campaign?
Yeah, it's a design. We deal with design from a graphic point of view too, how things look and how words sound and that sort of thing. But generally, that I guess you sort of do look at a campaign and you design a strategy that will work, and we're always involved in developing those things.
What about designing images? Images of a candidate or images of an issue?
Well,
do you do the kind of work that Doonesbury's quasi-mythical Duane Delacourt, Secretary of Symbolism, does? Is there any?
No, we haven't gotten involved in anything as like that.
We've been telling Harry Britt to pound his fist on the table a lot. I don't know. Image building, I don't think it really works. I mean, it works on a campaign in a national level for television, and you can mold a human being into something that they aren't. But in local stuff, like we deal with most, I mean, everybody knew Harvey Milk's strengths and weaknesses, and we couldn't have turned him into anything else if we wanted to, which we wouldn't. And all the campaigns that we work in, I mean,
well, apparently
they're human beings.
We succeeded in making the San Francisco Chronicle think that Harvey Milk was this very sedate, responsible,
well, that's true. We did.
Downtown financial analyst, and that was, you know, one of the things they mentioned in their endorsement of Harvey Milk. But no, I mean, as Dick said, I mean, locally here, it's impossible to make anybody into someone that they're not.
Have you ever put? Do you put candidates on diets?
Well, we try.
No. No, we've never put a candidate on a diet.
There won't be any campaign consultants diet calendar.
No.
Bestseller coming out.
Yeah, I mean, certain candidates sometimes look overweight, so we tell them to try to put their weight down. But I, of course, I'm not going
to. We're getting back to actually what designing a campaign means. Is that some people have a very scattered idea of what they're running for, what's going on. I mean, especially being a candidate or being in politics, there are a million people coming at you with a million different ideas and questions and demands and all that. And the general public has a very short attention span. And I think it's a responsibility of a candidate to put together a theme, a sort of point to why they're running, what they want to do, what's wrong. And it has to be fairly clear and fairly simple and honest. And so what we try to do is wade through all the static and the noise and everything and try to strike a clear note through the campaign. And sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's not, but...
Well, the people that have this, the American trip is that anyone can run for office or run for president. Anyone's good enough to do it. And, you know, of course that's true. But a candidate also has a responsibility to not bore people and to say something that hasn't been said before and to generally provide some leadership on something. But you get all these candidates who just sort of loosen their tie and throw their coat over their shoulder and talk tough for a few months and then disappear. And that they think that's the American, you know, system of politics, and they think that's actually going to benefit someone. And I don't think that's true.
Where do you think the business of campaign consultancy will take you in the next several years, say, not going further beyond that?
Well, we hope next year to do a lot of things around the state and going outside of the state even. San Francisco politics is so little, we end up talking to the same people all the time about the same subjects and dealing with people that hate us or we hate them or love us or whatever. And so we're trying to get beyond doing more things around the state and country. And I'm sure that's what we'll be doing.
One thing that is, as I mentioned earlier, fundamental to us is that gay people, well, we get involved in a lot of campaigns where in some cases we're the only gay people there, at least to start. And, you know, we want to, if a farmer wants to get elected in a farm part of town, or if a black wants to get elected in a black part of town, or anything like that, to know that a part of their campaign is being thought about, worked on, and supported by gay people. We try real hard to make sure that everybody knows that we're gay and that our friends are gay and that it's, you know, that gay people are an important part of the city and an important part of their campaign. And an extension of that is the fact that we're really committed to Harry Britt's campaign, that we have only one gay legislator in the country, except for, I think, someone in Minnesota. And, you know, history really, in our mind, requires that we have a gay person in office to whom other people can come. If firemen want a pay raise, or if environmentalists want a dam stopped, or if somebody wants better muni service, that they're dealing with a gay person, and that in the world of political wheeling and dealing and trade-offs and all that, that the requirements of gay people weigh as heavily and equally as the interests and requirements of any other group.
Our guests this morning on The Gay Life on KSAN, Jim Rivaldo and Dick Pabich of Rivaldo Pabich and Friends, the city's probably hottest
Thank you.
Campaign consulting firm. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Randy.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN. Our next guest this morning is Camille O'Grady, who was an ear witness to the murder of her close friend and business manager, Robert Opel, in the Fayway Gallery on July 8th. The people who were charged with the murder of Robert Opel were arrested at the San Francisco airport attempting to flee to Miami on July 11th. On July 12th, one of them, Maurice Keenan, escaped from the custody of sheriffs by just walking out of the Hall of Justice at the time of his arraignment, and he wasn't recaptured until July 31st in Miami. Now, there are a lot of other strange things that occurred in this case between the murder and the first capture of the suspects and between the escape and the recapture of Maurice Keenan that somehow seem very fishy, I think, would be the best word for it. Basically, outlining them, because there's much too much to go into in this short a time, what is it that makes you think something else is amiss in this case, Camille?
Well, basically, when these two men came into the gallery, they mentioned the name of somebody who I had met briefly before I ever saw those two. And it is somebody that is a known drug dealer in the South Market. And when I first met him, he supposedly was out of jail on a computer error. And I found at that time it very odd that he was back in his old neighborhood dealing drugs.
And you suspect that he was the connection between Robert and Robert's killers?
Well, he certainly was. He definitely was a connection, one way or another.
And he tried to contact you after the murder, too, didn't he?
Yes, the day after.
What was he trying to do then?
Well, supposedly he was had some information for me, mm-hmm. and due to the police not getting there for 2 hours to get me to deal with the information, I missed him.
So that at that point the police were either trying to avoid the opportunity to get some information or wanting you to walk into some trap without them being present or what?
Well, it's what I felt.
Either way or one in particular? Or?
Well, basically, if the person who whose name is mentioned by murderers calls somebody up, you immediately either think you're being set up to be a sitting duck or something.
Okay. And it took the police 2 hours to work to respond then to a fresh lead in a day-old murder case.
Yes, and the two men that were working on the case had not heard anything about it at all.
Okay, so then you ran into this man again at
yes.
the police station.
Yes, the next day.
And he was going out when you were coming in.
Right.
Did he say anything to you then?
Yes, he did. He came up and said, "I'm very sorry. I feel somewhat responsible for what happened." And right there in the police station said, "I sawed off the shotgun and drove Maurice Keenan to." He was sitting in the car in front of the studio when I was there the other day, and I had seen him there briefly either the day before.
This was sometime prior to the murder.
Yes,
he had driven Maurice to the studio.
Yes. And he walked out.
And the police heard him say those things.
Well, he told them that.
Okay.
And he walked out.
Did you ask the police why they let him out?
Yes. I asked them, if that man's out of jail on a computer error and he sawed off a shotgun, how come he's walking out of here? And they said, "It's all right. We know who he is and where he is."
Okay. So now that day you expected to identify Maurice Keenan in a lineup.
Yes.
And you weren't, there was no lineup at all.
Right.
Instead, you were just shown photographs.
Yes, I think we were shown photographs, but we ended up not having a lineup at all that day.
So there was no face-to-face confrontation with the people who'd been arrested and charged?
No, and they had been picked up.
Okay, so then there was another day or two later.
The next morning, there was supposed to be a lineup at 9, then it got postponed to 1. And we went down there at 1, and somehow Maurice Keenan got out of the lineup. And when we left the station, Anthony Rogers had told me
who was the other eyewitness
who had been and who was had seen pulling into the police garage on his motorcycle at 1 o'clock when we arrived, and assumed that he would be there for the lineup.
Now the police garage is not open to the public. That's
right.
Only for police vehicles and authorized people with passes and so forth.
Right.
So on one day the police tell you that they know who is and where to find him,
mm-hmm.
and on the next day you see him acting as an insider at the Hall of Justice, being able to use the garage, for instance.
That's certainly what it looked like.
And on both days when you expected to see the alleged murderer, Maurice Keenan, by one reason or another you did not see him.
Right.
And then on the following day he escaped.
Yes.
Then he is at large for 19 days.
Right.
Having walked out without anyone checking on him. And this is in a murder where the victim of the murder, Robert Opel, had 2.5 weeks before the murder performed a theater piece which was anti-police. I mean, what would the Dan White piece that he did on Gay Freedom Day, what would happen if a pervert, queer, faggot killed an ex-cop? Would he get away with murder?
Right.
And then you find the police missing leads, letting someone who admits to you that they participated in sawing off the shotgun, which became the murder weapon, letting them get away, letting him in and out of police garage as if he were some kind of insider.
Right.
Okay, what happens after the escape? Maurice Keenan is eventually found in Florida, but weren't there reports of his being around in San Francisco?
Yes, there were reports of him being seen at the Rainbow Cattle Company. And I had left town myself, and I actually was told that when I first got back in.
Okay, now that's a known hangout. That was one of his known hangouts.
Yes.
And there were supposedly wanted posters there.
Right. He supposedly was standing underneath one.
And yet the police somehow never found out about that.
No, they were called in apparently, and were running around and checking the buses and things, but I don't know.
Now, Maurice Keenan's father owns a gas station which is across the street from the Rainbow Cattle Company.
Oh, that's what I've heard.
Yeah, well, I went by there the other day, and it says Bart J. Keenan, proprietor.
Right. Yeah.
Now, this is the gas station which he supposedly went home from twice on the day that Keenan escaped, went home to his home in San Bruno for lunch from San Francisco, in such a way that he twice missed running into Maurice Keenan, who supposedly broke into the house to get the weapons when the San Bruno police were not staking out the house that the San Francisco police supposedly had told them to stake out because someone had escaped.
So there's a little too many communication breakdowns, I would say.
And on three different occasions, Keenan is reported sighted in San Francisco, but then he's finally captured in Miami.
Right.
And the San Francisco police seem unable to have stopped him at the airport, to have stopped him at his father's house, to have caught him at an old hangout.
Right. He also had called here from San Diego. That was in the San Diego paper when I was down south. So he was in San Diego, too, at one point. And I don't think that was even in the papers here, which I thought was interesting.
And then, no, it wasn't in the papers here. Now, some people say that Robert was murdered because it was a drug, just an ordinary drug-related holdup, someone trying to get money for their drugs.
Well, I don't believe that at all because I was there and saw what went on. And anybody, no matter how strung out they were, and these people were on speed, would, if they wanted to get money or take drugs, they would look for them. There was a wallet sitting on the bedside table that was a fat wallet, and they were in that room. And if they were really looking for money or drugs, they would have looked, and they didn't really do that. And Keenan certainly didn't. The other guy made perfunctory moves, and the $5 in the camera that they ended up with, Anthony practically pushed on them.
Isn't there lots of evidence, stuff that we can't necessarily talk about on the air, that indicates that these people were in fact large drug dealers themselves?
Well, they had a lot more money than we did, I'll tell you that. The basic thing I know about them is that they had money.
A couple of bisexual men who made a lot of money dealing in the gay community, drugs that were popular. Now, what I find very interesting to cap off this entire bizarre set of events. So a week after Keenan is captured, he waives extradition so that it doesn't take any legal proceedings to remove him from Florida back to San Francisco. And he may have gotten to Florida just there to be captured. He's arraigned, and the arraignment is delayed. Very strangely, the arraignment is delayed for an additional 2 days while he gets his legal counsel in order. And with that extra delay, on the final day when he's finally arraigned, the federal strike force on organized crime makes a bust of three people who they claim are the main suppliers of PCP to the gay community. We have this character who the police say they know who he is and they know where to find him, who has the ability to pass in and out of the Hall of Justice garage, which anyone who's ever dealt with the Hall of Justice knows that the security of getting in and out of the garage is tougher than getting in and out of the Hall of Justice. Someone who, in fact, looks like he is associated with the feds gets let in and out of custody, is not arrested, although he admits to someone who was an ear witness to the murder that he sawed off the shotgun, and there's this other arrest going on. It looks a lot to me, and this is just my impression from all of these fishiness that's going on, that the police and the feds let Keenan escape and let him out just long enough so that they could finish off this big case that they've probably had brewing for a long time. And that it sounds as if somewhere in that kind of miasma of the way police agencies operate, and we're dealing with at least a local police agency and a national police agency, as if Robert was getting sacrificed to someone's strategy or plans of how they were going to keep people quiet or hold someone in custody or keep someone away from someone else or get someone scared and then hold it off just long enough for them to make this bust. I don't think that yesterday's announcement of those three busts is disconnected from all of this other thing. I can't make out what all the details of it are. But I smell federal involvement.
Well, I certainly am sure there was somebody behind Maurice Keenan's gun besides Maurice Keenan. And I imagine there was money involved in it. And Robert had absolutely no business being killed in the scheme of those things. People may disagree with certain things he did, but you don't kill anyone for that.
But if this strategy required for them to get rid of someone who was a street-level user or maybe even a low-level dealer, if they had to get rid of someone in order to put their finger in the dike, as it were, and just keep the case from breaking before they could have 3 years of work fall down around them,
right,
wouldn't it be to their advantage to take someone who that if they killed him would inspire some political paranoia as well, which the murder of Robert certainly has done in the gay community?
Certainly. Certainly.
Do you think we'll ever know the truth?
Well, I'd certainly like to. There's going to be a trial, and it'll be interesting because I must say that when Maurice Keenan escaped, I was very surprised that they caught him. I didn't expect to hear of him being alive or around again, because I imagine that he must know something about why it happened.
So you think there will be a trial?
There damn well better be.
You think they're going to send him to jail?
As opposed to what?
Letting him off.
Over my dead body, they'll let him off. I shouldn't say that. And if they do, it's a very sad situation we're in. A dangerous one.
I don't know that I can say anything after that. Thank you for being here with us this morning, Camille O'Grady.
Thank you.
A March brawl at a lesbian bar has resulted in a police officer being convicted of disturbing the peace and battery by a San Francisco jury. A civilian companion was convicted of disturbing the peace. The two defendants, Officer Daniel Marr and Kevin Guerin, were also acquitted of one charge of battery stemming from a fight at Peg's Place, a lesbian bar in the Richmond District, on March 30th. Marr and Guerin faced sentencing on August 30th. Another officer, Michael Kelly, was involved but not charged in the Peg's Place incident. He and Marr will have a police commission hearing on August 29th. Gay Rights Advocates is nonprofit and tax-deductible. You can send donations to them at 540 Castro Street, San Francisco, 94114. That's Gay Rights Advocates, 540 Castro Street, San Francisco, 94114. Just a reminder that next Sunday, August 19th, is the Castro Street Fair. This is The Gay Life on KSAN. I'm Randy Alfred, and I also write a column, Taking Sides, for the San Francisco Sentinel, available every 2 weeks in gay neighborhoods throughout San Francisco. The Gay Life is produced for KSAN by Fred Green and myself. See you in 2 weeks.